Good morning. Good morning. We come to the 12th of our classes on the Passion Narratives today. We actually get to the crucifixion of Jesus. And since there's a lot of stuff there, we have only two passages that we'll consider this morning instead of the usual three or four that we've done in the past. And in this case, I've made composite readings out of all of them because different gospels include a few different details about the crucifixion of Christ. So I wanted to bring out all of those things, so I just put it all together. So if the narrative doesn't flow exactly, well, that's why. And I've got the, in your handout, I have the texts indicated for you. So first, Jesus is led to Golgotha. We'll start at Matthew chapter 27 and verse 29 with additions from Mark and Luke. When they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand. And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Then they spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off of him, put his own clothes on him, and led him away to be crucified. Then they compelled a certain man, Simon a Cyrenian, the father of Alexander and Rufus, as he was coming out of the country and passing by, to bear his cross. And a great multitude of the people followed him, and women who also mourned and lamented him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed the days are coming in which they will say to you, 'Blessed are the barren, wombs that never bore, and breasts which never nursed.' And they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry?" There were also two others, criminals, led with him to be put to death. And when they had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say, place of a skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he had tasted it, he would not drink. Okay. The routine for crucifixion was always the same. When the case had been heard and the criminal was condemned, the judge uttered the fateful sentence, "Ibi ad crucem," you will go to the cross. And the verdict was carried out then and there, according to Roman law. So the condemned man was first of all placed in the center of a quaternion, a company of four Roman soldiers, you know, one in front, one behind, and one on either side of him. His own cross was placed on his shoulders, usually only the cross beam. The upright was usually left in place. Scourging always preceded a crucifixion, and it's remembered, we described last time how terrible a scourging was. Often the criminal had to be lashed and goaded along the road to crucifixion to keep him on his feet as he staggered to the place. Before him walked an officer with a placard on which was written the crime for which he was to die. Okay, so the guard in front, or whoever was the supervisor of the guards, would carry the placard or the sign that was placed on the cross telling the crime. And he was led through as many streets as possible on the way to execution. There were two reasons for this. One was the grim reason that as many as possible should take warning, you know, from his fate, so it was a way to keep the population in control. But there was also a merciful reason. The placard was carried in front of the condemned man, and the long route was chosen so that if anyone could still bear witness in his favor, it gave them an opportunity to speak up. So if there was new evidence to be had, the man person might come forward with it, and in that case the procession was halted and the case was retried. So there was a merciless and a merciful reason for taking a long route to crucifixion, but that's the way that it was. In Jerusalem, the place of execution was called the place of a skull, or in Hebrew, Golgotha. Calvary is Latin for place of a skull. And it had to be outside the city walls, for it was not lawful to crucify anyone within the boundaries of the city. In point of fact, it's one of the things that we always see. When you see an icon of the crucifixion, you will always see the city walls of Jerusalem behind. Okay, so we know that Jesus took place. And it also says in the Epistle to the Hebrews, you know, that he went out of the city bearing his cross. Likewise, we don't have any permanent home here. Let us go out with him bearing our, you know, bearing our shame as well. Okay, we have no abiding city here. All right. It may have been called the place of a skull because it was somewhat skull-shaped. Tradition has it, however, that it was called the place of the skull because it is the traditional burial place of Adam. And so Adam was buried there. So then you have this whole symbolism of the second Adam, Christ, undoing the sin of the first Adam there. And this is why always in crucifixion scenes, I don't think we have it over there, you know, on ours, but very often in crucifixion scenes, you'll always see there's the little mountain there, you know, the little stones at the bottom of the cross, and there is a skull and a crossbones in there. All right? That's Adam's skull. All right? That's also where you get the skull and crossbones that go on the Jolly Roger for pirates' flags, and where in the old days, when you had a bottle of poison, it had the skull and crossbones on it too. Okay? It all comes from that image of Adam and his two leg bones, you know, which were there at the base of Calvary. All right, so that's the traditional understanding of why Christ was crucified where he was. Simon of Cyrene. So Jesus here is, because of the punishment that he'd had, because of the scourging and the mockery of the soldiers, see, he had also been up probably all night long because he'd been arrested after the Passover dinner. You know, the evening before, he was arrested in Gethsemane. He had been put on trial, you know, by the Sanhedrin, and early in the morning before Pilate, and all, the Sanhedrin again, and then before Pilate. You know, he was probably exhausted, physically exhausted, had lost a lot of blood now, and probably was staggering under carrying his cross. So Roman soldiers knew what to do in these kind of circumstances. Remember that Palestine was occupied territory. The Roman government was in charge there. And all a Roman officer had to do was to tap a Jewish man on the shoulder with his spear or his sword, and that man was now deputized into the Roman army and had to do whatever the soldiers required of them. It was a nice method if you were the guy in charge. That was how Simon ended up probably carrying the cross of Christ. So here he comes, Simon the Cyrenian. Cyrene, by the way, is in North Africa. All right? It's nowhere near Palestine. So he's from North Africa. So he's a Latin-speaking man. He's from North Africa. Probably Jewish. That's why he's in, you know, Jerusalem here for the Passover now. And what's this? He probably saved up, you know, money all of his life so that he could go to Jerusalem for the Passover, and he ends up carrying a cross for a criminal. Just his luck, you know? Mark tells the story, and that's why I include the verse from Mark 15:21 there, that he identifies Simon as the father of Alexander and Rufus. The only reason that Mark could have had for identifying Simon the Cyrenian as the father of Alexander and Rufus is that the people Mark wrote his gospel to knew who Alexander and Rufus were. So they mention him. Okay? Now, it's traditionally understood, and scholars are pretty certain, that Mark wrote his gospel based on the preaching of St. Peter to the church in Rome. Okay? So Alexander and Rufus must have been known in the city of Rome. Okay? And this is, in fact, borne out because when St. Paul writes his epistle to the Romans at the very end, when he's among the greetings in chapter 16 of Romans, he says, "Greet Rufus, chosen of the Lord, and greet his mother, a mother to me also." So it may be that in point of fact, we know there was a Christian in Rome named Rufus, and if he could be called one of God's chosen ones with a mother so dear to Paul, maybe this Rufus that St. Paul writes to might have been in fact the Rufus, the son of Simon, the Cyrenian who carried the cross of Christ. So there's a fine speculation for us, and a small world among the Christians as well. I included the passage from Luke's gospel there about the women of Jerusalem and their lamentation. Okay, behind Jesus comes a band of women weeping for him. It was easier, there was not such social stigma for women to be seen in the presence of criminals as it was for men. You know, which is why the disciples abandoned Jesus and fled in the Garden of Gethsemane, why St. Peter even had trouble staying in the high priest's courtyard, you know, when he was accused. Other men could have been accused as well. Women were not usually so accused, so it was safer for them to go on. It's sort of like in the bad old communist days, you know, where the babas and the yayas were able to go to church because they didn't have anything to lose. They didn't have any job. The Communist Party wasn't going to get after them or anything. So they had a certain freedom in that respect. And so the women had a certain freedom here as well. But Jesus turns to them and tells them to weep for themselves and not for him, because days of terror were coming. In Jewish thought, there were few tragedies as great as a childless marriage and not to be able to bear children or offspring. Childlessness was a valid ground for divorce under Jewish law. But the day would come when women who had no children would be glad that they had no children, because Christ is seeing ahead the destruction of Jerusalem under Titus and the Roman legions in the year 70, which was in fact a very terrible, terrible thing. They basically just sealed up the city and besieged it and allowed the population to starve to death. If you want to read horrific accounts of that, it's recorded in Josephus. So there it is. Let me see. Oh, and the verse 31 is kind of a proverbial phrase. You know, if they do this in the greenwood, what will they do in the dry? Basically means if they're willing to do this to someone who is innocent, what will they do to someone who is guilty? It's basically what how the proverb is to be taken there. All right. And then we have the situation of the wine mingled with myrrh. Okay. So when the place of execution is reached, the criminal had to be impaled on his cross. The nails had to be driven in, usually through the wrists because they were stronger than the palms of the hands. But commonly the feet were only loosely bound to the cross. At that moment, in order to deaden the pain, make it easier to get through the act of crucifying a man, and also to prolong his agony, criminals were given a drink of drugged wine, which was in fact prepared by a group of wealthy women in the city of Jerusalem as an act of mercy. There is a Jewish writing from the time that says, when a man is going out to be killed, they allow him to drink a grain of frankincense in a cup of wine to deaden his senses. Wealthy women of Jerusalem used to contribute these things and bring them. So perhaps some of the wealthy women of Jerusalem were following Christ and the two thieves in order, as a mercy, to deaden their pain a bit. Okay. The drug cup was offered to Jesus. He would not drink it. He did not want his senses dulled, and he wanted none of the pain of execution to escape him. So that is how our Lord was led to the cross. Thoughts or comments or anything on that? Nope. All right, then on to the scene of the crucifixion itself. There were two others, again a composite reading, two others, criminals, led with him to be put to death. And when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him, and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. Then Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. Then they crucified him and divided his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Sitting down, they kept watch over him there. And they put up over his head the accusation written against him, This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Then many of the Jews read this title, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. Therefore the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, Do not write the King of the Jews, but he said, I am the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, What I have written, I have written. Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and the other on the left. So the scripture was fulfilled, which says, And he was numbered with the transgressors. And those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, You who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and elders, said, He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the King of Israel, let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now if he'll have him, for he said, I am the Son of God. Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. Then one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him, saying, If you are the Christ, save yourself and us. But the other answering rebuked him, said, Do you not fear God, even fear God, seeing that you're under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we received the due reward for our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. Then he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, Assuredly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. Okay, lots of stuff in that. Lots of stuff. So, When a criminal reached the place of execution, his cross was laid flat on the ground. Usually it was a cross shaped like a capital letter T, not like a lowercase T, such as, you know, as we envision them. There was no top piece against which the head could rest. It was usually also quite low, so that the criminal's feet were only 2 or 3 feet above the ground. The victim's arms were stretched out on the crossbar. It was usual for nails to be driven through the wrist. The feet were not nailed, usually, but usually only bound to the cross with a rope. And halfway up the cross, there was a projecting piece of wood called a saddle, which took the weight of the criminal. For otherwise, the nails would have torn through his wrists, you know, just the weight of his body. Then the cross was lifted and set upright in its socket. The terror of crucifixion was this, that the pain of the process was terrible, but it was not enough to kill somebody. The victim was left to die of hunger and thirst and exposure to the elements and all. And many a criminal was known to have hung for a week upon a cross until they died raving mad. Jesus says a lot of things, you know, in his gospel, but this is one of the most tender, where he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." This is, by the way, the first thing that Jesus says from the cross. In the four gospels, there are 7 things that Jesus says from the cross, and I'll point them out as we go through the rest of this. And they're marvelous meditations just in and of themselves. By the way, little footnote, there are 7 things that the Mother of God says in the four gospels as well. And those are a beautiful set of meditations to go through on their own. And I've given a retreat on those. But this is the first thing that Jesus says from the cross, is to forgive them, for they don't know what they do. When Stephen was being stoned to death in the book of Acts, he also said, "Lord, do not hold this sin against them." So, you know, to be forgiving, even at the point of one's own death, is a high act of Christian virtue. The idea that this terrible thing was done in ignorance, the crucifixion of Jesus was done in ignorance, in fact, is found in a couple of places in the New Testament. In Acts chapter 3 and verse 17, Peter says to the people, "I know that you acted in ignorance when you crucified him." And later in Acts chapter 13 and verse 27, Paul said that they crucified Jesus because they did not know him. Okay, so there is some notion that you know, how could anyone have done it if they had known who Jesus was and what he was about? So some aspect of ignorance there. The dividing of his clothing. All right, we remember already, we've already said that when a criminal was led to his crucifixion, he went, you know, in a squad of 4 soldiers, you know, one on each side of him. Criminals were usually crucified naked, except if they had a loincloth, that was fine. The criminal's clothes became the property of the soldiers. It was one of the small perks of having to do the dirty work, okay? Most every Jew wore 5 articles of clothing: his shoes, his turban or a head covering, his girdle and inner garment, and his outer cloak. So there were 5 articles of clothing, and there were only 4 soldiers. So the first 4 articles were all probably of roughly equal value, but the outer cloak was more valuable than everything. And one of the Gospels says that it was made in one piece, it was woven in one piece, wasn't pieced together. So it's a little better, you know, piece of clothing. So it's probably that the soldiers cast lots for. So they probably threw dice. That's what they did. So they're shooting craps is what they're doing. When the soldiers had divided the clothes, they sat down on guard until the end should come. So there was also on Golgotha a group of 3 crosses. And in the middle was the Son of God, and on each side was one of these thieves. So he was with sinners even in his death. The inscription on the cross is the same as the placard that, you know, the officer carried, you know, in front when he was being led to his crucifixion. All right. In this passage, there's a couple of other things that we have to make mention of. The inscription on Jesus' cross, it says, was in Hebrew, Greek, and in Latin. So those were all the languages that were spoken there in Jerusalem at the time. Even though the Romans were kind of in control and spoke Roman or spoke Latin, a lot of the Romans even then spoke Greek because since the days of Alexander the Great, about 300 years before, Greek had become the lingua franca of the Middle East. And so even though Rome was an ascendancy, there were a lot of Romans still who spoke not only Latin but Greek. In point of fact, in the Church of Rome, all of the services, including the Mass, were all conducted in Greek until about the 3rd or the 4th century. Then there was a great controversy over changing the language into Latin, because by that time, few people spoke Greek anymore and nobody could understand the liturgy, so they switched to Latin so people could understand it. You know, and then it took until the 20th century until they changed it from Latin into the vernacular, which is something that the Orthodox have, not had quite as much a problem with. Okay? So at any rate, but it was in Greek, Hebrew, and Latin, which, you know, many have taken as, even among the fathers, as sort of a symbolic thing, because, you know, out of Greek culture, we got philosophy and reason and rationality. Out of Roman culture, the Romans were very good with law, you know, and with order, and with good government. And the Hebrews, of course, the religion and the worship of the true God and the prophecies about God. So the basis, you know, in fact, of Western civilization, of Christendom, when we still had Christendom, but certainly Western civilization is Greek philosophy, Roman law, and, you know, the Hebrew religion, which becomes Christianity. So those three things together are emblematic there on the inscription on the cross. If you care to believe it, there is in Rome a church called Santa Croce in Gerusalemme. I visited there when I was in Rome in 1981, and they have a great collection of relics there. It's really quite stupendous. Among them is the inscription of Christ, which is on a wooden board. It's about this big. Whether it's real or not, I don't know. But the curious thing was, it was first written in Hebrew, which of course is written from, you know, right to left. They also wrote the Greek and the Latin from right to left. It's very curious. It was backwards. So in order to correspond with the Hebrew. But anyway, there is that. So if you ever go, you can also see the index finger of Thomas with which he felt the side of Christ, and the spear of Longinus with which he pierced the side of Christ. There's probably also St. Peter's skull as a young man, and some of the darkness of Egypt. And, you know, somewhere there is a feather from the wing of the archangel Gabriel dropped when he made the Annunciation. So there are many wonders to be had in Europe if you care to believe them. Okay. I know it's early. That's a joke. It's okay to laugh. But at any rate, so there is the inscription that is there. And Pilate put the inscription on the cross of Jesus to irritate and annoy the Jews. Okay? They just said they had no king but Caesar. They refused to have Jesus as their king. So Pilate, by way of a joke, says just exactly that and puts it on the cross. Jesus of Nazareth, king of the Jews. All right? And the Jewish leaders, of course, objected to it completely and repeatedly asked him to remove it, and Pilate refused. Quod scripsit, scripsit. What I've written, I have written. Pilate's inflexible, wouldn't yield an inch. So it wasn't so very, a few hours before, you know, and Pilate's trying to get out of crucifying Jesus, trying to placate the crowd, trying to get out of all this responsibility and not have to deal with it at all, you know, finally allowed himself to be bullied and blackmailed into giving the, you know, Jesus over to crucifixion. But he was very, you know, so having been wishy-washy before, now he's going to be absolutely firm. Finally, the accusations themselves of the people who passed by. The final verses in the passage describe the taunts that were flung at Jesus by passers-by, the Jewish authorities, the brigands who were crucified with him. And they all center around one thing: the claims that Jesus had made in his apparent helplessness on the cross. And that is where they were all so very wrong. Every one of them said, and you know, even in Matthew's account, it says repeatedly, "You'll come down from the cross and we'll believe you. Just come down and we'll believe you." And that was the one thing that Christ was not going to do. Was not going to come down from the cross. Son of God, sure, we'll believe it. Messiah, sure, anything. Just come down from the cross. And the very fact that his enemies were so desperate for him to do that shows how important the cross is for Christ and how important it is for us. And we can't forget that. And so it's well, you know, that we're talking about this here on the Sunday of the cross, because we'll get to venerate the cross here, you know, directly at liturgy and to make our prostrations here before it as well. And then in the case of the repentant thief, it was deliberate that the Roman authorities crucified Jesus between two known criminals. They were making a strong point. They were staging this so that Jesus would be numbered with the transgressors, like it says, you know, in the prophecy, so as to rank him with robbers and so to, you know, to undercut any residual authority Jesus might have or any respect Jesus might have in anybody's eyes. Here he is with common criminals and thugs and thieves and all. Legend has it, or legend has been busy with the penitent thief. He's usually called Demas or Dismas, is the repentant thief. There's one legend that goes way back that makes him sort of like a Judean Robin Hood who robbed from the rich and gave to the poor and all. I don't know how accurate that is. The loveliest of the legends tells how when the Holy Family were on their way to Egypt, you know, when Jesus was newly born and they were fleeing away from Herod and the slaughter of the innocents, they were set upon by robbers. And Jesus was saved by the son of the captain of the robber band. And the young brigand found the baby Jesus so lovely he couldn't bear to lay hands on him and set him free. And said, "O most blessed of children, if ever there come a time for having mercy on me, then remember me and forget not this hour." And so that young robber grew up to be, you know, Dismas, who was eventually caught and crucified with Christ. So of course Christ saves him at that time as well. I remember Archbishop Fulton Sheen in commenting on this passage and about the thief said that with his words, "Lord, remember me when you come in your kingdom," that at that moment the thief stole paradise, which I think is a real nice way of putting it. Even to the end, he managed to steal his way into paradise. And which also shows us, you know, there's never a point in our own life when it's too late. Don't ever think you're too old or too far gone or anything, you know, to turn to Christ. If, you know, if this thief can on the cross with his last breath, you know, attain paradise, then so can we. That's not to say to, you know, to live a carousing life now in hopes that on your deathbed, you know, that you can do that. Let's not count on that, because as soon as you plan on a, you know, a peaceful ending to our life, painless, blameless, and peaceful, you know, we're going to seize up in a heart attack or get broadsided and T-boned on the freeway or something like that, God forbid. But, you know, you can't take, you don't presume on those sorts of things. You know, repent early this year as well. But the thief did steal, the good thief did steal paradise. And, it's there that, here is just one point that I didn't include in my notes, but it's something that I will include. It's important to point out, and it's a good time to do it. We're going to illustrate it right up there. That central panel on the north wall up there will be the scene for the crucifixion when we have funds to paint it. That's what will go there. And because there's a lot of real estate up there, it's going to be the full scene with Jesus crucified between the two thieves, with his mother, John the beloved disciple, the centurion, everybody else around there. You know, sun and moon darkened, angels, the whole thing. So we've got lots of space there. But if you ever look at an icon of the crucifixion, this took me years before I realized it. It is a perfect instance of what in the Middle Ages they called the coincidentia positorum, which is the $10 word, the coincidence of opposites. And it was a big idea, and the idea is like this. If you look at the icon of the crucifixion, what do you have? You have Jesus suspended on the cross between heaven and earth. In fact, the foot of the cross is buried in the earth, down where Adam is, so it goes all the way down to hell. So the cross unites hell, earth, and heaven. And at the same time, what do we have? I told you, Jerusalem, the city, is in the background. Jesus is crucified outside the city in the country, so you have city and country. You got the sun and the moon, which are up there, and they both hide their faces. So you have sun and moon, day and night, light and darkness. Okay? See how this is working out? You have two thieves. One is repentant, one is not repentant.
So one is saved and one's condemned. By the way, while I'm going at it, very often in Orthodox crosses, you know, the foot bar of Jesus is tilted at an angle. It points up toward the good thief and down towards the unrepentant one. Okay? That's one of the explanations for that. But there is Christ crucified between repentance and unrepentance. In the icons, his mother and the myrrh-bearing women are on one side of the icon. On the other side, you have John the beloved disciple, Longinus the centurion, and the other men. So you have male and female. The centurion is pagan, the rest are Jewish. So you have Jewish and pagan. You have, let me see, what else did I forget? I think that's it. I think that's it. But what you see, you have city and country, heaven and hell, sun and moon, light and darkness, repentance, unrepentance, male and female, Gentile and Jew. All of these opposites are all present in the scene of the crucifixion. And Jesus doesn't resolve any of them. Rather, he's in the center of all of these contradictions, and he holds them all together in tension. And it is through holding together these seemingly irreconcilable opposites that progress is made and a way through is found. And I don't know how else to put it other than that, except that when we find ourselves in similar circumstances, it's not we come down on one side or the other. You have to hold both together. No. And Christ manages to hold everything together in himself, in a supreme tension. It's actually exquisite and beautiful when you start looking at it and picking out all of the elements and beginning to find them. But that's what it is. And again, I know John is taking notes. It's the coincidencia oppositorum, just exactly the way it sounds, or you'd spell it in English, coincidencia oppositorum. And you can look at it. You can find it in Wikipedia, I'm sure, if you looked. But there it is. And then finally, just the last point that I have to make is that just the word paradise itself, when Christ says, today you'll be with me in paradise. Paradise is a Persian word, and it actually meant a walled city. When a Persian king wanted to do one of his subjects a special honor, he made him a companion of the garden, which meant he was able to walk into the garden with the king. And it was more than immortality that Jesus promised the penitent thief. He promised him an honored place of a companion in the garden, which is, you know, the kingdom of heaven. So anyway, there's one last little point there. Oh, and I did find out this too. I think maybe I mentioned this last time, that the crucifixion was originally a Persian. It was a Persian torment or a Persian mode of execution, because one of the Persian deities was the god of the earth, and they didn't want the earth tainted with the blood of someone who had been a sinner and a criminal. So they lifted him up off the earth so that he wouldn't defile the earth. That was the reason that was. And then, yes, I think I did tell you this, because from there the practice passed to Carthage in North Africa, where once the Romans defeated Carthage, it passed into Roman practice. That's right. So anyway, there it is.